In the morning, wind from the north at 13, 36 degrees in Racine, 35 now in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am delighted to welcome back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, author of After the Cold War, and a frequent guest to the morning show to offer his analysis of all kinds of different current events and issues, both domestic and international in nature. And it is always a stimulating conversation indeed. Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much for welcoming me. It's always nice to be invited back, especially here.
Glad to have you here. And we have lots to talk about. And one of the things I want to start with, because I enjoyed your blog so much on this topic, was the landslide election of Lori Lightfoot to be the next mayor of the city of Chicago.
Yes.
And
not far from Kenosha.
Right. And you talk in your column quite a lot about Chicago's proud history, but also about the depths of its current fiscal crisis, and this is what primarily confronts Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot. So first of all, I thought it would be interesting for someone who lives in Illinois, you have had maybe a closer perspective and have watched this this slide over the years more closely than maybe some of us up in Wisconsin have, but explain as best you can, at least, how Chicago finds itself in such desperate financial straits. And maybe as you do so, you should maybe help us understand just how serious a situation this is.
It's well, it's a very large subject, and I appreciate your asking. I write about various things that I'm not, like a lot of professors, I'm quite willing to voice opinions. I'm not an expert on urban and metropolitan government, public administration. My family and I have lived in the greater Chicago area since 1976, so it is now home. My parents were from Chicago, although they emigrated, like a lot of people, during World War II to California, and I was born and grew up in Los Angeles. To actually answer your question, governments do have taxing authority. It's not like business. Former Governor Scott Walker liked to trumpet that Wisconsin is broke. governments are never broke as long as they have a tax base. The city of Chicago reflects the same kind of serious problems that other metropolitan areas have, except they're worse, thanks to relatively irresponsible government in Chicago and at the state level for many years. Both entities find themselves with pretty heavy current and anticipated debt loads, especially given the concessions made to public sector unions. Mayor Rahm Emanuel, who I think has done an extremely commendable job and is an extraordinarily gifted politician, operator, executive, has done an admirable job of attacking these problems head on. He's been frustrated. But again, there is a tax base. As long as you have some kind of steady income, cash flow, as our business friends like to say, things are manageable. So Chicago is not going to go the way of Beirut. It's not going to go the way of Detroit, although that was a real possibility, a true economic disaster occurring. We'll see how the new mayor performs. But the heavy debt load, especially related to public employee pensions and an aging population, is particularly dramatic in Chicago. But other metropolitan areas face the same difficulty. New York, thanks to Mayor Bloomberg and a couple of predecessors, was able to dig itself out of this kind of hole. There is income, but it is a challenging situation facing Mayor-elect Lightfoot.
Right. In your column, you cited overspending as at least a significant culprit, as I suppose it almost always is when cities find themselves in this particular situation.
Cities and states and people and lots of entities and businesses.
Right. So is it as simple as cutting your spending?
Well, you have commitments to unions, many of which were made by Mayor Richard M. Daley, Emanuel's predecessor as mayor, who was not a good executive and not a good mayor, in great contrast to his legendary father, Richard J. Daley. And Richard J. Daley deserves a lot of credit for marrying executive and management skill with brilliant political skill, all of which was masked by his rather semi-coherent, bizarre speaking style, but a truly great leader. And therefore, the decline has been particularly steep because the standard he set was so high.
Right.
But it's the problem of commitments that have been made that are underfunded. We have the same problem at the national level, by the way, especially with the legions, armies of old people expanding steadily with major commitments in Social Security and Medicare that cannot be met. Mm. They will be met, but they cannot be met given current income and expenditure trends.
Right. That balance sheet just doesn't balance the way it's currently constructed. So when you write about Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot, I think one of the things you point out quite rightly is that because she is a series of firsts, Chicago's first African-American woman mayor, who also happens to be openly gay, I believe, that there are a lot of headlines generated just by those facts alone. I think you point out quite rightly that for all that might matter in certain respects, what matters the most is what kind of a manager she is going to be as
mayor. Exactly.
And what can we look to in terms of her own background and experience and skill set to hazard an educated guess as to what kind of a manager she will be and if she's going to be equal to the challenges she faces?
Well, since you bring up the ever prominent headline factors of race, gender, and lifestyle and matters related thereto, Chicago had an African-American mayor, Harold Washington, who governed or tried to govern very courageously in a time when racial tensions were much higher than today, believe it or not, in the 80s. And Jane Byrne, an interesting, colorful ally of Richard J. Daley's and something of a protege of his, was also mayor of Chicago. Lori Lightfoot combines various dimensions. The article tried to emphasize what you quite rightly brought up initially, thank you, the fiscal and management challenges of Chicago, which are tough and involve homework. It's much easier in the media and beyond the media to talk about lifestyle, gender, the usual things that have become more and more dominant in our public discussion and media discussion because it's so easy.
So what kind of a manager does she need to be? What needs to be managed and how? I mean, if you were in a position to advise Mayor-elect Lori Lightfoot, what would you be telling her that she needs to do? I mean, beyond whatever that word management means, I mean, what does it mean for a city like Chicago? What needs to be managed better and in what way?
You have to rise at dawn, work 12 to 15 hours a day, minimize contact with the press, and negotiate, not nonstop, but devote yourself to negotiating with the powerful interest groups in Chicago, which today and also in Richard J. Daley's time in the 50s into the 70s, powerful political interests that need to be reconciled. Institutionally, the mayor of Chicago has a good deal of power, which provides a good deal of leverage over interest groups. The Lincoln Yards urban development, a very ambitious effort to gentrify a significant part of traditional urban Chicago, involving tax increment financing, government benefits, two business tax breaks to facilitate investment. She's already had what I think is notable success in this morning's news. She was able to get the very powerful real estate interests, which are pressing to go ahead with this development, and which she opposed. She's changed her position. Her public statement is the investors involved have agreed quite readily, given the power of the mayor's office, to devote a lot of money to focusing on preferential hiring of women and minority-owned construction and other related firms. That's the kind of leverage that a mayor can apply, and which Rahm Emanuel, with enormous energy and dedication, has been willing to devote.
Well, we will.
So that's encouraging. She also has related experience at Mayor Brown, one of a world-class corporate law firm, where she was a senior partner, which always involves politics, but is not something you get for affirmative action reasons alone. She proved herself to be able to work and compete and bring in income in that very, very demanding environment. And that firm, like any other big successful firm, and especially in a major city, has partners who will be able to help her provide leverage if she plays her cards right with very strong interest groups.
Right. One thing that has been pointed out in the coverage is how the woman who opposed her, and I'm blanking on her name. It's
Toni Preckwinkle.
Preckwinkle, okay.
Difficult name.
Right, right. Was seen by some as representing Chicago machine politics.
Yeah, well, she does.
And
that's
so,
right.
So in a sense, the landslide election of Lori Lightfoot seems to, at least in part, be perhaps some kind of indication of the state of affairs of machine politics in Chicago right now versus the heyday of machine politics, which you talk about in your column.
It represents the fact that we're in a very populist era. A lot of voters want change. Voters are always discontented because people are always discontented. But I think that her victory, like the victory of President Trump, at least in the Electoral College, and the victories of Bernie Sanders on the other side in 2016 in the primaries and caucuses, especially caucuses, reflects the fact that voters are they're anxious for change. Toni Preckwinkle is the president of the Cook County Board. She's also chairwoman of the Cook County Democratic Party, which was a tremendous source of Richard J. Daley's power. It was an office that Richard M. Daley did not have. Times are changing. Law enforcement, it doesn't mean that we are becoming better people or more moral people. My personal bias is that things are moving in the other direction long term. And the college university admissions scandal currently dominating the media is Exhibit A, in my view. But law enforcement is becoming more professional, more consistent, and more reliable. And what was business as usual as recently as the 1970s is no longer acceptable. And President Preckwinkle is caught in that. A close ally of hers long-term, Alderman Ed Burke, is under federal investigation. He hasn't been indicted yet, but our listeners will, most of them, be aware of the fact that he is in serious trouble because the feds are after him.
Right.
Things that were once upon a time, historically, part of business as usual in politics, are against federal law. And the entities are far more consistent than they used to be. I think the evidence is undeniable in enforcing the law. She's an ally of Burke's. Ms. Preckwinkle also ran a very, very poor campaign. For a long time, she was inaccessible to the press. She did not handle questions very well. Lori Lightfoot, as many of our listeners already know, is remarkably articulate and quick-witted. And when it came down to the two of them, in a populist time, she had tremendous advantage.
Right. Well, we'll be very interested to see what she does as Chicago's new mayor and what is ahead for that great city with such a proud history.
On the income side, this is important to stress because it's totally ignored in almost all media reporting and analysis, including serious media like public radio and television, is Chicago, the city of Chicago, is losing population steadily over the long term. However, business income, including tax income from businesses and the urban development project I referred to earlier, is a prime example of that. More than half the interstate truck traffic in North America goes through or around the Chicago area, including southeast Wisconsin. There's tremendous, steady new investment. The Kenosha Area Business Alliance, where our president, John Swallow, is quite active. He's vice chairman of the board. At their annual meeting, they provided a litany of new investment in this area about a week ago. The Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce, two of their senior officials, including the president, were there to make presentations to the business community in southeast Wisconsin. Private capital is plentiful and growing in this area. Chicago is more and more a global center of finance and services, as well as manufacturing, even though we're not the heavy industrial center that we used to be. Please keep that in mind with all the scare headlines and kind of angry commentary.
Good point. Very good point.
Thank you.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Dr. Art Sear, a Clausen Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage, Director of the Clausen Center, a frequent guest to the morning show, offering his thoughts and analysis on a number of different sort of questions and issues. Speaking of elections, there's been a heck of an election in Israel, at least by some measures, perhaps still too close to call. But just say a quick word about the difficulties of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and why he finds himself in as difficult a position as he does right now.
Well, he's been in a difficult position for years. He's a great survivor. We were talking about survivors off the air, including President Trump. There are, like Ed Burke, he hasn't been indicted yet. However, he's under very aggressive investigation, along with his wife, I believe, by Israeli law enforcement officials. And although he may be the next prime minister, a government has yet to be formed. He appears to be the front runner as usual. There is a good chance that he will be indicted. He's a very durable prime minister, a very hard-line prime minister. My own personal view is we'd all be better off if our friends and allies in Israel were more flexible, especially concerning Palestinian sovereignty and statehood. But he has a tremendous ability to appeal to the voters. He did state explicitly in the last campaign that he plans to annex occupied territories, occupied by the Israeli military since the 1967 war. The United States has, until the current administration, very successfully and effectively resisted that unwise policy. He's demonstrated, especially in the last election, how far he's willing to go in order to survive in office. He actually issued a quasi-apology after the last one because of his overtly, crudely, really offensive, racist references to the Arab population. So this guy will do what it takes to win, and we'll stay tuned.
Right. What would happen if he were indicted? I'm not suggesting you're an expert on Israeli law or...
No,
or,
I'm not even an expert on American law. But right. Fortunately, we have the mock trial program, and thank you again for having Mike Fegley and our students on after our last spectacular, their last right. spectacular season right. from which we all benefit.
Right.
I don't know what Israeli law is and whether a sitting prime minister is at some level protected. If there's a serious indictment that comes down, my guess is that he will be forced to resign. Nobody has a majority anymore in Israel, and it's through a shifting coalition of mostly far-right, zealous, in my view, extremist parties that Netanyahu has been able to survive and sit on top. But it's very fragile and very shaky.
Speaking of fragile and shaky, let's talk about Great Britain and Prime Minister Theresa May and the fact that since we last spoke, at least once and maybe twice, she has re-presented her Brexit plan, and it has been soundly rejected by Parliament. And the deadline or the actual date of the exit occurring has been postponed a bit.
But, they keep postponing it, yeah.
Right. So any sense of where all of this is headed, not only in terms of Britain, but also Theresa May herself?
I'm quite confident her days are numbered. She's proved to be a very weak prime minister. She did succeed decisively in the election to become leader of the Conservative Party after David Cameron resigned. He had a referendum, in very much at his personal initiative, about staying in the European Union in 2016. That was narrowly defeated, I believe, 52-48 of those who voted wanted to leave. To me, that's never been a decisive result. But he resigned. It's a very rough system in Britain, and if a prime minister is seriously embarrassed, he or she usually resigns. Theresa May is determined to hang on, but her days are numbered. She proceeded to outsmart herself after she became leader by calling a snap election in 2017, which she didn't have to do. He didn't have to call the referendum. And the Tories, her conservative party, lost their very narrow margin in Parliament. She is dependent, and her government is dependent, on about 10 members from the Ulster Democratic Party, which is extremely committed to remaining part of the Irish economy. Mm. They are committed to staying in the European Union. And she is in this very vexing situation, even if she were a strong leader politically, of having a government that is basically a minority government. She's not been able to hold her own party together. On one hand, there are people who are very anxious to get out of the European Union. On the other hand, it was the Conservative Party that got Britain into the European Union, the European Economic Community, in 1970. And she has two wings that she hasn't been able to hold together, along with the fact that there's a Labour Party that's divided. A Scottish National Party is represented in Parliament. They're very much pro-Europe, as are the Liberal Democrats, another third party. It's an enormously complicated situation. But the British have never been comfortable with Europe going back hundreds of years, never comfortable outside of military alliance with any kind of long-term institutional commitment to Europe. And that's reflected in the long-term ambiguity about the European Union. Theresa May was part of a younger generation of Tories elected in 1997 who are characterized by extreme hostility to the European Union.
Mm-hmm. One of the things you point out in your most recent column about Britain and Brexit is the fact that there is a component in this, in terms of American interests, that is often overlooked or very much under-discussed, and that is around the whole matter of intelligence. Explain to our listeners how intelligence is wrapped up in this question of Brexit and how that could be affected by Britain actually leaving the European Union? How is the matter of intelligence and counterintelligence affected by that?
The European Union involves by design all sorts of detailed sharing of information and collaboration, including among police agencies and government intelligence arms in Europe. Theresa May, before becoming Prime Minister, was Home Secretary, and she was on the record as stating that one of the problems if we leave the EU will be that we won't have the sort of ready access, unless we negotiate carefully in advance, ready access to criminal records, police records, and intelligence information. The article that I wrote really was more about Anglo-American relations, spurred by Brexit, but more about Anglo-American relations than European relations. Our special relationship with Great Britain dates from World War II. It began before Pearl Harbor with vital economic assistance to the British, who were fighting alone for a year against the Third Reich. But also it began with intelligence cooperation. And the British were very cautious. They really tested out the Americans to see if we were at all professional and at all willing to be disciplined about information gathering. And my understanding of the historical record is as both sides became more confident with one another, close intelligence collaboration resulted. FDR appointed a Republican, actually, an Irish-American lawyer and leader in New York and Boston, Bill Donovan, to head the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the predecessor of the CIA, and he really spearheaded this close collaboration with Britain. I argue at the end of the column that there are opportunities in adversity always, and certainly in this high-stakes arena. There's something called the Five Eyes, involving the intelligence agencies of Britain, the United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, which dates from World War II, is important, and I argued that if Britain does, in fact, have a rough and acrimonious departure from Europe, there'll be opportunities for greater intelligence cooperation. And I still believe that to be the case. President Trump, in his first days in office, shared classified information with President Putin and the Russian ambassador to Washington, which set off the media and politicians and in different countries. And there were comments about how this might threaten Five Eyes cooperation. It's really up to us whether we continue to maintain a good partnership or not with these other countries.
Well, you brought up the name
But it's really important. It's really important.
Yep, absolutely. Well, you brought up the name of President Trump, so let's talk about something you wrote very recently in the wake of the Mueller report finally coming to an end, of course, with a result that was... For those that oppose President Trump, of course, was not what they were hoping it would be. It did not bring further indictments. It did not lower the boom on President Trump in terms of collusion with Russia and so on. It remains to be seen. A lot of people are leaping to conclusions without having yet seen the full report, which is still being prepared for limited redacted release. But I was interested that your reaction to the Mueller report was to kind of paint what I think is a really compelling picture of Donald Trump as survivor. I mean, as a world-class survivor, he has survived some, very close calls over the course of his long kind of checkered career. And I wonder if you could just kind of characterize for our listeners, who I hope will seek out your column, what you're kind of spelling out there. It's a story that a lot of us really don't know.
Donald Trump spent a lot of time and spent a lot of money, did not make money, but devoted a lot of resources to real estate investments in New York and New Jersey, where his father, who made the great fortune, was quite active. And when gambling was legalized in casinos in New Jersey and Atlantic City in the 1970s, Donald Trump became very active as an investor there. New Jersey has a long criminal history that is a matter of fact. A very successful, I think, Netflix series, Boardwalk Empire, was a Hollywood melodrama, but it actually was based on the history of mafia domination of New Jersey and large parts of New Jersey finance, and especially Atlantic City. With Prohibition, Atlantic City became a major offloading port for liquor, which was illegal but remained even more popular during that time. And almost uniformly corrupt state and local officials simply didn't enforce the law and profited from that. That is the background to what happened in more recent times. With legalization of gambling, the criminal but very stable and rather orderly mafia family in Philadelphia, headed by a man named Angelo Bruno, suddenly found themselves facing all kinds of new investors, a lot of them from mafia families in New York City who were far more aggressive, far more reckless than Mr. Bruno and his associates were, and Atlantic City became a very, very violent, crime-centered area. And they're still, I think, struggling with the legacy of that. Bruno himself was murdered by a shotgun blast when he thought he was in friendly territory in front of his and his wife's apartment by people that he thought were his friends. And after that, it became even more open and wild. There is a book by Ovid Damaris, a serious crime researcher and investigator that I read some years ago, called Boardwalk Jungle, not to be confused with a Netflix series. And there is some extensive discussion of Donald Trump in this book, and I went back to it, and my memory was accurate, at least in this case. The younger version is like the style of the president we have now. He was very loud, very brassy. He managed to antagonize a lot of people. He was able to find investment capital. None of his very little of his own money was involved in a casino hotel complex that was opened with his name in lights on the top. It closed down in 2014, had never been particularly profitable. An important ally of Donald Trump's, Carl Icahn, who was an early and important financial supporter of his presidential bid, bought the deed to the property, which shielded Trump from all kinds of civil lawsuits. The Abscam sting, a federal prosecution effort, brought down seven members of Congress, including one senator, all kinds of real estate types, some judges, gamblers, entrepreneurs, gangsters, all kinds of people were indicted and convicted during this turbulent time and very violent time. Donald Trump appeared. He moved through with what seemed like reckless abandon. But I made the point in the column, he was never indicted. He was never caught on audio or videotape. A lot of people were. I believe he has a much underestimated survival instinct that has helped him in his political career, and it certainly helped him survive physically, in literal terms, during the jungle warfare period in Atlantic City and the environs of New Jersey. That column has generated a fair amount of comment. There is a newspaper that's published my column for years. The editor wrote to me that we don't follow the logic of this. I think because I wasn't bashing Trump, but seemed to be defending him. Got angry letters from people. I do think it's an accurate observation and helps to me in any way explain the president's remarkable physical survival and great political success currently. Hmm. He's certainly not stupid.
Right.
I'm not defending him. I certainly, in my own personal opinions, are quite contrary and critical of him. But I think the Atlantic City experience is insightful. And I don't generally get a lot of comments, I think, because I'm so reasonable, not because I'm so aged and dull. But this column seemed to set people off, including liberal editors who think they're professional journalists, who got upset that, in their mind, I seem to be defending him.
Interesting. And what you were
well, it is to me. I'm glad it is to you as well.
Yeah. So what you were trying to do is just point out some of the qualities that Donald Trump has that have allowed him to survive potential controversies and scandals that would have consumed somebody else. What would you say are the nature of those survival skills? I mean, yes, he manages to survive, but how? I mean, how take apart what you think those survival skills actually are. And I'm also especially intrigued by the notion of survival skills that would work, you know, in terms of a New Jersey casino would also work in the current day, where the challenges he faces, I should think, are a bit different, or it's certainly in a different landscape.
Almost a primordial ability to sense danger and be aware of sensations, evidence, inferences, make inferences that you're in dangerous surroundings, quite separate from intellect. We all know very fine, good citizens, highly intelligent people, many of them professors, who don't have this primordial capacity. But it's something that's not much commented upon. It generates comment. I don't think I'm sure it's not as profitable as the kind of nonstop drumbeat criticism of Trump from most of the media. But it was sparked by the Mueller report. And indeed, after 2 years of speculation and anticipation and hyperventilation and, you know, talk substituting for factual reporting, suddenly the report comes out and says there was no collusion. To me, that helps explain why it's hard to nail this guy,
right?
Bluntly,
right. And of course, you point out in your column that the matter of obstruction of justice, in which he is not exonerated in the Mueller report, can be a difficult charge to sort of gather
together.
Yeah,
well, we'll see. I'm certainly not defending the president, especially his personal behavior. And I'm not saying he's innocent, but he really does survive.
Right.
Yeah.
It will be interesting to see if, for instance, the U.S. House is successful in their efforts to get a hold of the president's recent tax returns.
I mean, yes.
When you start talking about terms like that, then old-fashioned survival skills, I'm not sure how relevant they even become at that point. But
the people, our fellow Americans collectively, also certainly aren't stupid. And the people are comfortable with divided government, especially nowadays, and there are good reasons why. The voters wanted the Democrats to take over the House in the last election. And so we're going to be seeing a lot more adversarial political maneuvering by both sides,
right?
The administration and the House,
yep,
majority.
One of the recent columns you wrote points out a really important anniversary, and it's of something that I know is kind of near and dear to your heart, and that is NATO. NATO turns 70 years old this year. And of course, President Trump has had some withering criticism of NATO, but NATO endures, and you say NATO endures for good reason.
Well, I started by quoting The Economist, the British weekly that I've been reading since graduate school, in which I'm giving commercials for and endorsing. That's a very good use of your time. There's a very fine column that appeared in connection with the 70th anniversary of NATO, Alliances Die Young. There were a whole series of shifting alliances that the British engineered against Napoleon, the British and others, but as usual, the British were the main players on the continent. And they lasted an average of 5 years, which was news to me. Napoleon lasted a very long time, more like 15,
yeah,
before he was finally defeated at Waterloo and exiled. After the defeat of Napoleon, the British engineered a comprehensive Congress at Vienna, which reintegrated France into the rest of Europe, a lesson that unfortunately the Allies managed to forget after World War I. The French were reintegrated in a sort of informal concert and then Congress of Europe. The great powers, conservative as well as relatively liberal for the time, collaborated diplomatically and occasionally militarily to ensure peace and stability in Europe. NATO was created in 1949 to contain the Soviet Union and their allies and reflected the fact that the Cold War was beginning. The Soviet Union disappeared now about a quarter of a century ago, and NATO is still around. I think it performs this concert of Europe's stabilizing role. I think that the Clinton administration was very prudent and sensible not to try to extend the borders of NATO right up against the Soviet Union. I'm very sorry that the successor Bush administration, and especially Vice President Cheney, spearheaded an effort to really squeeze the Russians psychologically as well as geographically. We've now retreated to a more kind of middle position. We still have new NATO members in Russia's traditional sphere of influence, but they tend to be smaller countries. But it's an extremely important alliance, and it's, since we focus so much on bad news, inevitably, it's a very positive success story for American diplomacy. The Truman administration, in important ways, reinforced by the Eisenhower administration. Dwight Eisenhower had been the first military commander of NATO, Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, the same title he had in World War II, the ground commander in Europe. The alliance, for all the tension, remains durable. There have been problems from the beginning. I do think President Trump's rhetoric tends to reinforce and create further difficulty and distance. But it's nothing new for us to have tension with our European allies. It started during the Truman administration.
Hmm. Well, it's an important legacy, and it's also one of the things that we probably don't spend enough time talking about and reflecting upon, and especially in terms of what a difference it that is NATO makes on the overall world scene.
Well, they're now intervening. I have mixed feelings about out of area conflicts, but they are intervening pretty far afield, including in Afghanistan, where our intervention to overthrow the Taliban regime was sanctioned, that is, approved by not only the United Nations but also NATO. And NATO exercise, and the forces there are, the remnant forces are very much under NATO command.
Well, it's an important anniversary, and I'm glad that you pointed it out. You pointed out another notable anniversary, and I'm embarrassed to say that this anniversary completely slipped past me until I read your column. April 9th, 1939, 80 years ago, was the dramatic occasion when contralto Marian Anderson sang so impressively and memorably on the front steps of the Lincoln Memorial. And my eyes lit up, but I was not expecting an Art Sear column to be talking about.
Well, I
Marian
wrote that
Anderson.
For you.
Of course you did. So in all seriousness, why did you feel moved to take such prominent note of this anniversary of Marian Anderson's concert?
Well, I do know you read my blog, but it's historically it's an important event, and one thing we should be doing, serious writers in the news media and in academia for sure, is bring up things that people tend to overlook. Mm-hmm. She was already an enormously successful singer, an African-American opera singer whose voice was uniquely beautiful according to all kinds of reports from the time. And she, with that great talent, managed to escape from poverty in Philadelphia, had already toured Europe, and was a major, quite rightly recognized star in the U.S. and overseas. She had been doing annual concerts in Washington to benefit Howard University, the very important African-American university, longstanding. And the audiences had been getting bigger and bigger, so it was planned for Constitution Hall. And the Daughters of the American Revolution, Social Register, founding fathers and mothers, you know, old families, old money, a lot of it Southern, that dated back to the Revolution, they were involved in managing Constitution Hall, and they absolutely refused to have her sing there because she was black. And that created a public furor. Eleanor Roosevelt, the First Lady, was a member of the DAR, and apparently she agonized. She was a uniquely influential person back then and afterwards, more influential in the public sphere, I would argue, than her husband, enormously popular Franklin Roosevelt. She agonized, and finally she didn't want to be seen as trying to exploit the event, but she resigned from the DAR. And then Harold Ickes, the Secretary of the Interior, took the initiative to organize a concert at the Lincoln Memorial. And on April 9th, 1939, Marian Anderson sang. It got huge national press, estimated 75,000 people were there. And if you look at the article, there's a picture that I found quite striking from the National Archives of the big audience there that was just, people all over the mall. Like the famous civil rights march that Martin Luther King and associates put together in 1963. It shows just how vexed and ugly this history of racial strife in our country and any country. We're hardly unique. Mm. We do a better job than most. But it shows how important a single event can be, and especially artistic talent that everyone recognizes, how that can overcome difficulties. And she went on to continued success. Eisenhower made her an honorary ambassador to the United Nations, an honorary member of our delegation. John Kennedy awarded her, near the end of his life, the Presidential Medal of Freedom. So she certainly survived the DAR.
And how?
And I tell you, the DAR ain't what it used to be.
It's, yeah, right.
From my point of view, they were never all that desirable. I don't know how influential they really were, but they're less influential than they used to be.
Right. That was the beginning of the end in a lot.
Yeah,
lot
so
of
the
respect.
Good guys win if you can simply put up with all the bad times and turmoil.
And I have to say that for all that I knew about that event, I also never knew, I don't ever remember it being pointed out in anything I've ever read about Marian Anderson's concert, that it also happened to be on the anniversary of the surrender of the Confederacy at the end of the Civil War. That occurred on April 9th, 1865. That's a striking coincidence that I don't ever remember anybody noticing until I read your column about it.
Well, thank you, young man. That's why I'm where I am. Obscure information
there
that
we go.
Might be of some use. It was when Robert E. Lee's Army of Northern Virginia surrendered to the Army of the Potomac under General Grant, and that was not the end of the Civil War. It continued fitfully into the summer and fall out west. Hmm. But I believe the last Confederate Army was commanded by an extraordinary warrior who happened to be a Native American. But April 9th was the big surrender.
Right. So an important day in
absolutely.
Our history.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The good guys won again, thank God.
Well, on that on that optimistic note about good guys winning once in a while, we need to bring this to a close. But Professor Art Sear, it's always a great pleasure and privilege to speak with you, and I look forward to having you back shortly to have yet another illuminating conversation.
Well, thank you. You're very kind, and it's always a tonic.
Professor Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business at Carthage College, Director of the Clawson Center, author of After the Cold War, a columnist and whose work appears in a number of different newspapers and journals, my guest today on The Morning Show here on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Nan Calvert is back with an environmentally themed program. And on Friday, we will be observing the 150th anniversary of PEO, the Philanthropic Educational Organization. They were founded 150 years ago by seven women in Mount Pleasant, Iowa, and have been encouraging women to seek out education and greater opportunities ever since. We'll be talking with several representatives of that group on Friday. We remind you that The Morning Show is now available as a podcast through Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and Spotify. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackandDrea.com for more information. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degree. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha Racine.